from 6 on 2FM.
Thanks for the two, Johnnies. It's Tuesday, the 30th of May, and this is Game On. Coming up today, it's rugby, soccer, Gaelic football and motorsport between now and 7 o'clock.
So we're going to chat all about that with Peter Canavan, Stephen Kelly, Alan Cawley and Keen Tracy, and we're going to learn a little about the next wave of Irish talent in motor racing. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
So Marie, the people in Clare have a massive problem with getting all the way to Cork.
We're very environmentally friendly down in Clare now. We wouldn't want to be increasing our emissions and heading all the way to Cork. We're happy enough just to stop into Limerick.
That's you're absolute leaders in the country.
We are.
You should be so proud of yourselves down there. We'll give Limerick home advantage because we don't want to go to Semple Stadium.
Well, it's the Ennis Road, so I mean, feels like
it's kind of half Clare, is it?
I mean, you could argue it.
If you live in that side of the Shannon in Limerick City, you really should be supporting Clare, is it?
Limerick people are trying to take some of Clare off us, but we're standing firm.
Are they?
Yeah.
Are they that desperate?
They are that desperate to be part of Clare.
What do you think yourself, though? Home game for Limerick, or are you thinking this is...
I think it's always going to be difficult to beat them anyway a second time. And I don't know if the Gaelic grounds is going to hold a huge amount of difference on the day. A lot of those Clare lads would have been very used to playing there underage. Like, obviously, it's Limerick's home ground, but they would have played there quite a lot at different levels. So, and like, it's when I say it's only in the road, it is only in the road. Like, now it doesn't feel like you're heading into Croke Park from Kildare, if you know what I mean. You can nearly see it from.
You even have to bring the sandwiches. Is that close to home?
You can leave
the sandwiches at home, yeah?
You can leave the sandwiches at home. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And even things like, you know, when you'd, like, a lot of the lads would have been in school in Ordskull Reach and go to, like, probably live close enough to Limerick. Some of them might even live there. So I don't think it's that big a deal. It's better than having to go to Cork. I think Limerick wanted to play it in Cork and Clare didn't, so.
Curiosity-wise, attendance, Gaelic Grounds, Semple Stadium, Parky Cueve. Parky Cueve is 40-odd.
Yeah.
What's the Gaelic Grounds?
Oh, 30-odd.
Still, big crowd.
Yeah, producer Ronan's going to find out now and let us know. It's going to be very hard to get tickets.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah. I thought Clare might be generous to their fans and go for a bigger stadium.
They've been generous on the cost of travel.
If you can get a ticket.
That's it.
But don't worry, don't log. It's live at RT at 1:45.
It's on very early though, isn't it?
You'll be up, will you?
1:45 seems early, yeah.
You'll be on Sunday Sport anyways. Yes. What difference does it make to you if it's 1:45 or 4:45?
I have three games myself, you know, for the big ones.
All right.
Build up it for the day.
And what is on at 3:30 to set amongst the finals on at 1:45?
Don't know, there'll be something else on anyway. I'll get Ronan to check that out.
Leinster final, I assume, is it?
44,000 for the Gaelic Grounds.
Is it?
Yeah, there you go.
There you are now.
That's a lot.
It's obviously grown since you were last there.
There's more Limerick fans since I was last there. Anyway, we have a Limerick man on the line, but he's on the line to talk about rugby. How are you, Keane Tracy?
Not too bad. Controversial Limerick man, because I'm one of the ones who lives on that patch of land. Well, that's where I'm from, where they're trying to take it off. So, controversial, Marie.
And what's your thoughts on it?
Well, I'm not a GA man, I have to admit. So it really doesn't bother me.
Meant the patch of land. Does it devalue it by making it Clare, or is it worth more value than making it Limerick?
That's even more controversial. I'm not saying anything.
And Keane, are you all not the one there now? Like, is it still like rugby GA, or are rugby fans and hurling fans now all the one? Like, is it cyclical, is what I'm saying? Are you still very much one or the other?
Yeah. Well, we spoke about this a couple of times, I think, Marie, over the last couple of years on the show, but rugby is back now, I suppose, with Munster's win last weekend. So this is, I suppose, what rugby in Limerick has been crying out for the last few years, because the hurlers have been so successful. So massive, massive win for so many different reasons for Munster last weekend.
Marie?
Yeah.
It's called the bandwagon.
I know, yeah.
You just jump on whichever one's winning.
Yeah. Whichever one's going in the right direction, that's the one you jump on. The Ireland rugby squad, well, the extended squad, 42 players named today by Andy Farrell. Any major shocks, surprises, Keane?
I don't think so. I don't think there's any major shocks. I think you could definitely make a case for a couple of players who didn't get in there. But I think, by and large, look, I mean, it might seem like a long time ago now, but we have to remember that Ireland won the Grand Slam They have a fairly settled squad in terms of injuries. There was no way that Andy Farrell was going to rip up the script and, like, what are we, like 100 days actually, I think, today out from the start of the World Cup it is. So there was no way that he was going to rip up the script and have a raft of new players who weren't used to the squad environment, the game plan and things like that. So, yeah, he's gone with 42. I kind of thought he might go closer to 45, and you might say, well, is there a big difference between 42 and 45? Not really, but I thought he might have gotten a couple of guys who haven't been in the squad just to bring them in even for the experience. But Andy Farrell, since he's come in, has been really, I think, firm on the fact that he doesn't want to hand out any cheap caps. And I think that probably applies to calling people up as well. So I think a couple of Munster players in particular might feel a little bit hard done by, particularly with the run that they put in, like we just mentioned. I mean, guys like Jean Kleyn, who's arguably been, I would say, Munster's player of the season, and Shane Daly probably not too far behind him. John Hodden had obviously had a brilliant game, man the match performance in the Stormers win at the weekend. So guys like that are very, very unlucky, but it's very easy to point at them, but you got to take someone out of the squad for them to get in, you know what I mean? So it's easy for people to kind of be whinging about certain guys, but you can't really argue, I think, with a lot of players that are in there. Obviously, Joey Carberry's left out. Not really a major surprise. I mean, this time last year, it would have been a total shock. But the way the last few months have gone from him, it's not really. Jordan Larmour, another guy, bit of a surprise maybe. Robert Balakoon has probably paid the price for Ulster's poor form this season. And then you have guys like Jacob Stockdale, Dave Kilcoyne, Kieran Treadwell, Joe McCarthy, who probably a little bit fortunate to be in. But Andy Farrell is quite loyal in his selections as well. So you can understand why they're there too.
I guess, Keane, to me, the surprise was not going with 45. 45 is three teams of 15. I just thought it made more sense for a training squad to have that sort of a number. But I guess the way he's left it, there's only nine of these guys not going to make the World Cup bar an injury.
Yeah, so it's going to be narrowed down to 33 on August 28th. So look, there's so much water to cross under the bridge between now and then. Obviously, if you're not in this 42-man squad, it's a long way back. But as we've seen over the years, injuries can happen. They're going to play three warm-up games. Injuries can happen in training. There was no limit on how many players that Andy Farrell could have selected for this training squad. I think Wales had something like 54 for Warren Gatland, but that's the opposite end of the scale because Wales are kind of scratching around in the dark trying to find their form. So I think Scotland went for 41. So there's no hard and fast rule. But look, Andy Farrell, since he's come in as Ireland head coach, has, you know, a couple of times gone with a couple of left field selections, like Jameson Gibson-Park springs to mind, and look how he's turned out. So he is totally 100% earned the right to pick who he wants, because he's proven that he is a very shrewd selector.
So what happens between now and the 28th of August then, just in terms of what the players do from a training perspective?
Well, the Munster lads are still in the pub, Marie, I believe. So they're still enjoying
themselves. They're entitled to be. We'll give them that.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So what happens now is for the next, I think it's maybe 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks, the players will all go off on their well-earned holidays. Because, like, geez, when you think about it, it's been a bloody long season when you go all the way back to New Zealand last summer. So they'll go off for 3 weeks. The squad will reconvene. They'll be put through their paces for a couple of weeks. They'll have another week or so off, and then things will really ramp up sort of in July. So they have three warm-up matches. Like I said, this still feels like a long way away at this point, but it's going to come around quickly. They're going to play Italy at home on August 5th. They're going to play England at home on August 19th. And then they're going to France to play Samoa, which is a real, I suppose, test in terms of what they're going to face when they play Tonga in the World Cup. You'd imagine they're going to be very, very similar sort of tests. So they're going to go over to France. I think it's in Bayonne. They're going to stay down around Biarritz, a nice part of the world. But that'll be kind of a dry run for the World Cup. And then on August 28th, the 33-man squad will be picked. And like I said, you just keep your fingers crossed that all these guys are going to be available for selection. But you can think of so many examples over the years where guys just pick up injuries in training, and those warm-up games can be really treacherous. So Andy Farrell will be hoping that's not the case.
I mean, you look at it, obviously they start against Romania on the 9th of September, and I thought it was interesting going through their games today. Tonga a week later, South Africa a week after that. But then there's a 2 week break to the Scotland game. Logistically wise, will the Irish team stay in France for that fortnight, or could you see them coming home?
They have to. they have to stay in France, as is my understanding. The tournament regulations mean that, they have to stay. They have to stay in the country. So it'll be interesting to see how they juggle that, Ruby. But I think if you were going to get a 2-week break, then after you play South Africa is probably the best time for it, because you can imagine there's going to be a lot of battered and bruised bodies.
10 days after in a nice spot.
Exactly. I mentioned. And even the week before they're playing Tonga, that's going to be an unbelievably physical test. It's a game they absolutely should be winning, but the Tongans are no shrinking violets either. So I think in a weird way, Ireland will welcome that 2-week break. You know, you could point to them losing if they do have momentum built up, but it just gives guys that extra kind of bit of time to recover, and then they ramp up the last pool game. And obviously, depending on what happens in the South Africa game, that could be a do or die game against Scotland, and then it's the real business and the meat of the tournament that ends. So lots to water, like I said, to cross under the bridge before then. But you can be sure Andy Farrell and his coaching staff, now that the domestic season is finished, are really starting to think about what lies ahead.
So Joey Carberry is not in the squad. What do you think this means for his Ireland future long term?
It's hard to know, really. I absolutely wouldn't be writing him off. I mean, the guy has already battled back from a career-threatening ankle injury. And when you think about it, it was this time 4 years ago when he suffered the initial injury in one of those warm-up games that I'm talking about. It was against Italy, if memory serves me correct. And it was an injury that was pretty bad. And you can't blame a guy for wanting to go to the World Cup, but it proved to be a really disastrous decision, really, because it cost him more time out of the game. And you'd have to say he probably hasn't recovered since then. But if anything, he did show that he was mentally enough to be able to, not have his career ended. So I wouldn't be writing him off. But it's a very difficult time in his career. I mean, you could see him on the podium last weekend in Cape Town. He was in his tracksuit. And, someone like Jack Crowley now has stepped up to the mark. And even Ben Healy was playing ahead of him. And Ben Healy is no longer a Munster player coming in the next couple of weeks. He's obviously off to Edinburgh to play for Scotland at the World Cup. So, a difficult time, Marie, but maybe, if he gets a summer off, I mean, there's no surprise that he's not in this extended training squad, but maybe a summer off just to recharge the batteries and come back fresh. And the fact that Ben Healy won't be at Munster next season and Jack Crowley, in all likelihood, will be at the World Cup means that when the season is going to start a little bit later, it's in mid-October, I believe, in terms of the start of the new URC season. So that's going to mean Joey Carberry is going to start as Munster's first choice out half then. So maybe that's the best thing for him, to allow him to play himself back into form. But you never know, a couple of injuries and the door could reopen for him. I think Andy Farrell knows what he's capable of. He's delivered for Ireland in the past. He delivered for Ireland on that New Zealand tour last year in coming off the bench in all three games. So, and like I said, Andy Farrell does put a lot of faith and trust in guys who've delivered for him before. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that we won't see Joey Carberry at the World Cup in France, but it's obviously a long way back from here.
It is a long way back, but there is a huge attrition rate in rugby. We all know that. But those players that haven't made it, that are on the fringe, John Klein, John Hodnett, Nick Timoney, Joey Carberry, Jordan Lamour, etc., would they be on any kind of, not probation, or will Andy Farrell
have a standby list?
They'd be on a standby list. Do we have a standby list, or do they have to do extra training, or are they just back in with their province whenever that is?
Yeah, so they'd be in with their province, and they'd be told they are on a standby list. I suppose the beauty of the World Cup being in France this year is that it's easy to get guys in and out. I mean, I remember 4 years ago when we were in Japan, it was a total nightmare because obviously getting guys to Japan is much more difficult. So you can be sure that there'll be a decent enough standby list. Guys will be told that when they're going away on their holidays, not to lose the runner themselves altogether. Not that, in fairness, in the way the modern game is, that not many of them do that anyway. But yeah, they'll be keeping their phones on, and I wouldn't be surprised. Well, it's almost a guarantee that even over the course of the August games, that someone that's not in this 42 player squad is likely to be called up even to train, because like you mentioned, Ruby, the attritional rate is just through the roof at the moment. So It's not impossible for someone to force their way in, but in terms of getting to that 33-man squad, you'd have to say if you weren't selected today, then it's a very much an uphill task.
Keane Tracy, thanks a million for taking our call this evening. We have a quick break to take. We'll be back with Keith Duggan and Adam Fitzgerald.
Game on 2FM.
Well, welcome back to Game On. You know, Marie, I'd say Gillian would love to have a button like you have to just cut me off in mid-sentence whenever she could.
That was accidental.
I'd say it'd be a wish for her.
It's actually very handy. I'm surprised I don't use it more often.
So am I.
Yeah, I have all the power, and yet I still let you ramble on and rabbit on as much as you want. I'm going to have to stop that. And I'm going to have to stop it for good reason right now, because we have two guests in studio. I'm delighted to say that Keith Donegan, the owner of RPM, is with me here, and Adam Fitzgerald, driver with RPM. They're both here in studio. Guys, you're so very welcome. It's been really exciting following your story, both Keith and Adam. I guess a lot of us would have grown up watching Formula One, but not really understanding what a big deal it was and how difficult it was to make it to the top. But you guys are starting your journey, and it's really exciting. Keith, you're the owner of RPM. You're only 26. Adam, you're the driver. You're only 19. Ruby, they look so young. They look really,
That's
really young.
They are young.
They are young, exactly. But Keith, tell us a little bit about how you got to this, to where you are now.
Yeah, firstly, Marie, thanks for having us on. I started off like Adam as a driver, and then basically I got to a good level in the sport. I raced in the States, I won a scholarship over there, but I was always really interested in the technical side of racing, so that kind of drew me to the engineering aspect. And then I did business in college as well, so I thought I could run a team, and then I took the step last year. I always wanted to be in a really competitive championship. I wanted to measure myself against the best of the best. So what other place could I do it other than a European stage and a European championship? So, that's kind of how it all started. And Adam's one of our drivers for this year, and we're in our second full year in the championship, and it's going well so far.
Keith, there's loads of people that are into the technical side of every sport, and most of them go off and get a job as an engineer or get a job with a team. How did you decide that, hey, I'm just going to buy my own team?
Yeah, it was 2018, Ruby, to be honest. When I was working over in, when I was racing over in the States, I hadn't enough money for the full drive, so I was working in the workshop during the day, and I really liked the whole buzz of being in the team. And then I was like, okay, look, at this point I really want to have my own team. So then I set my sights on doing everything I could to try and raise enough funding to start the team. And an opportunity kind of came up there in 2021, about 3 years later, after I made a decision of what I wanted to do with racing in the future. And here we are now.
How much pressure are you under? You're running a business in Navan, you're running a team in Italy. I know you're 26, but this is pressure.
It is, Ruby, yeah. It's definitely not easy. It's hard to juggle everything, but I suppose when you love something, when you're passionate about it, you just find a way. Like, you have to make it work. There's no other option. And it's hard to kind of, after a high at the weekend, come straight back into work on the Monday, back down to earth. But my mum is good at keeping me grounded and keeping my 2 feet on the ground. And you know, you have to play on no matter what the results are like at the weekend. So it's a lot of pressure, but yeah, I love it.
Adam, so 19, you only a few years ago were a fresh-faced rugby player, and yep, you have now got to the stage where you are driving for RPM and the world is your oyster. How did you get to this stage?
Yeah, first of all, thanks for having me. Like you said, I played rugby for most of my childhood up until the age of about 15 or 16. And about around that time, when I was 16, I got into karting through a friend of my dad's who introduced me. So I had a go at that. I went to my local kart track up in Meath, Attaboy, found a team up there, hopped into a kart just for fun, driving around, loved it, fell in love with it straight away. And from there, I fell in love with the goal of Formula One. And from there, I started watching it and trying to plan out, okay, is it possible? Is it possible? Is this a goal that I can achieve? And if so, how do I go about getting there? So I did 1 year of karting in the UK, British Karting Championship. And then from there, I moved up to British Formula 4 in 2021. That went well. And then towards the end of that year, Keith reached out to me to discuss the possibility of me racing for his team this year, RPM. And at that time, I was following their results, and they were making really good progress. And when I had the first meeting with Keith, I was just really, really impressed, you know, from the operation he runs. It's really impressive to be competing on that level in Europe, and in his first year in the championship, to be taking on them top teams and even getting a pole position and two podiums, I think it was, is really impressive. So it seemed like the best decision for me, and luckily I was able to make it work, and now I have one of the seats in the team for this year.
Adam, I feel like you've taken us on a really whistle-stop tour of how you get from a rugby pitch to a motor racing circuit there. But
yeah, I kind of jumped through the years fairly fast, didn't I?
Jumped through a hell of a lot, I would say. I was no different than any young fella. You get in a cart, you think it's great crack, but trying to keep the cart on the track and trying to understand the aerodynamics, the spin, how to even overtake, get the flow of the person in front of you. You've no background in motorsport. How much learning did you have to do?
A lot. So, like, for context, most people I'd be competing against would have started when they're probably 5 or 6 karting. So, yeah, I jumped into one of the most competitive karting championships in the world in England my first year. So I had so much to learn competing against drivers who had 10 plus years of experience. So that's what it was. It was learning. But I was so committed to it. I mean, this was during COVID, and it was tough even to get over to England. I remember every time we'd have to get the ferry over to England, we'd do a night sailing from Northern Ireland. We'd arrive into Liverpool Port at 5 a.m. maybe, drive to the track and be on the track that same morning. And we'd do that every second weekend for the whole year almost. So being in Ireland too made it even more difficult, as well as, you know, coming over there, learning, dealing with setbacks and bouncing back the next weekend, trying to improve.
And obviously there's the buzz, but obviously the technical aspect of it most interested, to say you've kept learning. What did karting teach you? What did you learn most from karting that inspired you to go into cars?
There's so much things. I suppose understanding, you know, what it's like to put, whether it's a car or a kart, on the limit of what it can do, and understanding how that feels and how to react and how to get the most out of the kart, and in qualifying and in the races. You also learn how to, you know, handle race situations, the pressure, everything like that, race starts. So karting teaches you the fundamentals. But then when you move to cars, it's different again, because, you know, it's completely different. You've got the aerodynamic side of it. You've got the so many different things you can do with the setup of the car, which I had to learn as well. Like the car, the difference in the teams is made by, you know, the knowledge that they have with the car setup and, you know, stuff like that. So yeah, it was a lot to learn.
Racing is about losing. I know that more than anybody. How are you with losing?
I would say I'm fairly good. I've had a good bit of experience with it now. Like most drivers, you know, car racing is very up and down. It's rare for someone to, you know, dominate. It's some weekends you're quick, some weekends you might struggle a bit, but I think in the weekends that you do struggle, that's the times where you learn the most and progress the most, because it's easy to, you know, have a good result and just forget about it. But when you're struggling, it's where you really break it down, analyze it, and then try to come back stronger for the next weekend.
I'm the only one in this conversation who has no experience of trying to steer something that's going really fast. Keith, just even that point of it, just the whole speed and the danger element, when you guys are in it, when you're watching it, when you're watching Adam and the other drivers as well, do you ever get worried?
Not really. I suppose the competitive aspect, Marie, takes over. Like, even it's difficult sometimes whenever you see a car even crash or go off in the race, you're disappointed before you're worried. You know, you're saying, "Oh, missed opportunity. You know, we could have like had a really good result." And I suppose it's different for the parents. It's different because they have the whole safety aspect too. And I know when I was racing, my mum was petrified. Like, she couldn't watch any of the racing, because the speeds that Adam and these guys are doing, it's unbelievable. Like, you're talking almost 250 kilometers an hour, so it's over double what you do on the motorway. And it's very difficult to put that feeling across to people of what it's like driving at them speeds and the corner speeds with the downforce on these cars. So it's a short answer is I do care about the drivers, but I care a lot about the results too.
You're not thinking like when your 70, 80, 100 grand car goes off the track and is left in mush, business. Oh my God!
I had a bit of experience with that in the first race weekend. Actually, I had an injury where I fractured 3 vertebrae. So that was not a a good start, it set me back quite a bit. So I have a bit of experience with that, but yeah.
Ruby, you know all about that.
I do, yeah. Compression.
I was afraid to say that.
Yeah, he's the
only good thing about vertebrae is that they do heal. That's a good sign.
Yeah.
But Keith, the business element of it and getting the sponsorship, getting backers, getting, it's not sponsorship, it's investors you need.
Yeah.
How difficult is that?
It's really difficult, Ruby, to be honest. In the last few years, it's improved because the awareness around motorsport with Drive to Survive has been great. It's been brilliant for the junior formulas like us because everybody's looking to see who's going to be the next Formula One world champion. That's really who Adam is competing against and Adam is trying to be. So there is more interest filtering down from companies and from investors, and it's not easy, but it's definitely looking positive for the future. There's a lot of big names coming into the sport, and obviously we depend a lot on it, so it's obviously very heavy financially, and we need good partners and people that really believe in the sport to help us be successful as a team.
You have three cars competing now. You're a couple of weeks to your next race, which is in Hungary, I think, is it?
Yeah, it's in Hungary, Hungaroring, yeah.
Hungaroring. But you're going to get three cars there, three drivers, three teams of engineers, tyres, etc., etc. Do you ever sit down and think, where am I getting the dough?
There was times, last year was very difficult, Ruby, to be honest. It was the first year, so we had to set up everything. And you're kind of living race to race on the edge, and this year it's settled down because we haven't had to invest so much in the team. But last year there was points where it was touch and go, and you're kind of living race to race and hoping that you're going to get some good results. And we were lucky enough then towards the end of last year we could show our true potential, which left it easier then for this year. Like Adam was telling you, we had the two podiums and pole position, so we were really competing among the best teams, and we could be regarded as one of the top teams. So it's a very, very fickle game. If you're one day you're at the top, you know, one day, you know, no one regards you anymore. So you just have to stay on top of your game all the time, and there's usually more bad days than good, to be honest.
Ruby, it sounds like a small trainer trying to compete with Willie Mullins.
It is, but I mean, when you think about it, like, Adam, you can obviously, or you will hope to qualify into Formula 3 and take the steps up along. But Keith, where can you bring this team?
Well, for me, Ruby, the goal would be for RPM to get it to an F2 level. It's not realistic to say I can get it into Formula 1 like Eddie Jordan, but I can definitely take it to that level. Obviously, you need billions of investment now to get into Formula 1, but I think we're only two steps away from where we can be. We entered at quite a high level and we've showed what we can do. So now it's just really trying to get the investment and the partners on board to be able to take RPM to the next level and then keep the results coming, because at the end of the day, it's a results business.
And when you get it, or you hope to get it to F2 with Adam going with you, have you got something you can cash in?
We'll see when we
please
get to that point.
I swear to God, I am full of admiration for you. If you have put your neck on the line here and you're building a business that's a motor racing sport and you can get a F2 and cash in, I think you're a hero.
But I have to say, this is as interested as I've ever heard Ruby now in anything. He loves this.
Right, so you're talking about people say, where do you go in the world? We have a 19-year-old, a 26-year-old standing in the studio, putting their money where their mouth is and their life on the line. How do you not admire that?
Well,
thanks, Ruby.
The perfect way to finish it, because that's exactly what you're doing. And guys, thanks so much for coming in and chatting with us today. And I echo everything that Ruby says as well. And we're looking forward to following how you get on over the next while. We're going to take a quick break now, though. But stay with us, because Alan Cawley and Stephen Kelly are standing by to look back on the Premier League season.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. Someone from a brave man in Navan who's putting his money where his mouth is, to young Adam Fitzgerald, the driver, to a pair of footballers who thought a brave decision was one of them where they'd wear their hair at the weekend. Stephen Kelly and Alan Cawley, how are you?
Thanks for that, Ruby.
Yeah, you're welcome. Right, lads, what do we think? Where are we starting, at the top or at the bottom?
You call it.
Yeah. Oh, can I start? Do I like a nice show quickly? Yeah. Well, I'm going to start just with Home Farm, won the 12s girls team, going for the treble. My niece is in a Yasmin. They've won the All-Ireland. They've won the DDSL.
No way. Oh, fantastic.
The two league games left. They're going for the treble. So I want to give a shout out to the team, all the players. Yasmin, well done. Good luck tonight. And yeah, if that's okay.
Yeah, of course. Cheers. It is. Who they play?
They're playing Talla tonight and they've won one game after this, but unbelievable achievement. Like they've won the All-Ireland DDSL trophy and now they're going for the treble. So yeah, not the only team.
Big time. That's
competitive sport, Marie. You can't beat it.
Yep.
Let's not go there because we don't have enough time tonight. But I think even just talking about that and the treble and under 12, I think that probably...
And Timmy, give Timmy a mention.
Timmy,
go on.
Oh, we got him last night,
yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. All winning. Anyway, let's move on to the...
My 13-year-old's going to England this weekend, riding the Irish Polo Club team.
Our kids are not that far off Adam there. He's only 19, which is the scary bit. Anyway, Premier League, guys, where to start? I think we should probably... start at the top because we did speak about the bottom over the last couple of days and just the fact, Stephen, that it's Man City again, and it kind of raises the question, how many years in a row do you think we're going to be talking about it being Man City again?
For a lot longer. The way they played the season, the way Pep has changed even with the team, the dynamics, the interchange in the positions, everything about the way they play is just... It's pretty phenomenal. You see them live, you see them in the flesh, it's off the charts. And then they've added that string to their bow with Haaland. So not only can we keep the ball, but if you try and press us, we can counter-attack you. So looking forward, it's a bit bleak for the rest of the teams, I think, going forward. But, you know, everybody's going to try and strengthen this summer. They're going to try and bring in as many players as they can to counteract it. But not only do they have the best squad, they have the best manager. And that's the difference, isn't it?
Alan?
I think there's two discussions around Man City. There's the football one, which is absolutely incredible. As we all know... as Stephen said there, in terms of the way to play, the players that they have, and of course the manager that they have, it's absolutely incredible, and it would scare the life out of all the other teams and managers. And then there's the discussion around the asterisks over them in terms of the charges that are against them, the ownership, all those question marks that come with that as well, and they have to be addressed and fixed ASAP. I know Guardiola's calling for a quick, but that'll go through a rigorous process. But until that is addressed, there will always be an asterisk around them in terms of that ownership, and that's the worry, because you can't have state-owned football clubs the way we see now, and there has to be some sort of regulation brought in relation to that. In terms of the financial fair play, they're obviously manoeuvring their ways around that at the moment as well, which has to be looked at. But that's the thing for me in terms of the football side is incredible. You can only applaud them and admire them. And Guardiola is, because you could actually say about other clubs, if they spent the same money, but if they had Guardiola managing them, and I actually think it's true. So money isn't everything. You have to spend it wisely, as we see with other clubs spending a fortune.
Chelsea.
That
isn't everything.
That's the difference. But Pep is the difference.
But they do have an unbelievable coach, a manager that demands the best out of those brilliant, brilliant players and gets even more out of them.
So, Stephen, if Pep is the best manager, who is the manager of the season?
It's hard not to look past him, and I think the way Arsenal started and the way he's changed him, but then you look at Eddie Howe, I think he's exceptional to get Newcastle to where they are. De Zerbi at Brighton, the way they play, it's a brilliant style of football, really interesting, great to watch. And then people like Gary O'Neill, who Bournemouth, like 100% they were getting relegated. I wouldn't have, like, everybody here would have said Bournemouth were going down. So there's a load of names in the hat, but you know, the one that jumps out the most is probably Pep. I just think the way they play, when you see them live, I just can't get my head around how the players interchange positions and stuff and all. I know there's the money aspect of it, but the actual style of football, he's completely changed football.
Yeah, you'd have Alan, to give it to, sorry Ruby,
you're going to Daddy, but what about Eric in Man United? Would you have taken third cup final, league cup winners? I mean, would you have taken this 12 months ago? I believe I would have.
100% Ruby, yeah, and he deserves a mention. Not sure about manager of the year, but he definitely deserves a mention, because when you think of what he inherited and all the debates and discussions we had around this and the criticisms labelled at the players and all the stuff that has gone with Man United over the last 3-4 years, when you think of what he inherited, you think back to that Brentford match, which was an absolute disaster. You're thinking a small centre half getting all the criticism, how is this going to work, the Ronaldo situation. So when you think of, he's come through all that, handled it really well, come out of it looking good and finishing third, winning the League Cup, and obviously have a chance of possibly beating Man City in the FA Cup on Saturday, I think he deserves a massive mention and has done a great job, but still a lot to do.
Stephen, what way does Jurgen Klopp look at the year?
With disappointment. I think it's the only way you can look at it. Liverpool not getting Champions League is a bit of a disaster for them, from how close they've pushed City for such a long time. But I think someone has to fall on his shoulders. You know, the recruitment side of things. I think Liverpool, from an outsider looking in, you could see the middle of the park was waning physically. They just didn't have the attributes to do what he wanted them to do as a team. And then towards the end of the season, you see him trying to slightly change his style. He was almost picking up Pep's. He was putting Trent in that midfield role, you know, trying to get more out of him, leaving the defenders less one-on-one situations. So I think he's going to be gutted that they didn't achieve Champions League. And it's a rebuild. It's going back to the drawing board when it comes to midfielders. You've got attacking in the forward areas, loads of talent, loads of pace, but it's building up and the support act they need in the middle, I think, to get in and really cement players down that can come in, whether it's a Caicedo, McAllister, Bellingham's off the charts, but he needs players with abundance of energy to play the style of football he wants.
Alan, we should probably mention Unai Emery as well in that manager conversation and Aston Villa finishing seventh and getting Conference League football.
100% Marie, yeah, and I'm delighted for him as well, because he was almost ridiculed when he was the manager of Arsenal, and largely down to obviously his pronunciations in terms of learning a different language over here, which was how difficult, and it was almost like he wanted to come in and prove a point, and I felt it was really kind of disrespectful the way he was treated in his first spell. So for him to come back in the manner that he did, as you say, with Aston Villa, almost like a new look team in terms of the energy to play with. Ollie Watkins looks like a new player. I think he's picked up 49 points since he's come in as well. Like, that's championship winning form. It's been incredible. So he deserves massive amount of credit, Unai Emery as well. So fair play.
So we've done the manager backslapping. Now we're going to do the manager with regrets. Is Graham Potter top of that list for leaving Brighton?
Yeah. I don't think he'll regret it because of the way it went. I think if he was offered that job again, he'd still take it. I don't think you can turn down an opportunity to manage Chelsea. If you're an ambitious manager and you want to move forward, Chelsea's a club that they'll give you the tools when it comes to buying players. It's whether or not you can handle those players. And look, that's the difference with Pep. Pep has a squad of unbelievably talented players, but he manages them, they play for him, they respect him. Potter went in there and that was obviously a little bit not the same, and you know, Chelsea demand results quickly. He was given a little bit more time than what he probably would have got under Abramovich if he'd been in charge. But yeah, it'd be disappointing for him. And it's where he stands now. What jobs and what opportunities he's going to get.
Crystal Palace he's been linked with.
Yeah, instead of Roy. Yeah, that would probably be a decent fit. Apart from the Brighton connection, Palace and Brighton don't exactly like each other. But going in there, that would make sense. But Roy Hodgson has done an unbelievable job going back there.
I still think his stock is high though, like, because of the job that he'd done at Brighton. And to be fair, we all know Chelsea can be a bit of a basket case in terms of the way they treat managers. To answer Ruby's question, I would agree with Stephen. He had to take that opportunity when it came. Obviously, it went a bit pear-shaped for him. I have huge sympathy for him in that regard. But I still think he's a very, very good coach, a very good manager. And I still think he'll get his chance again with
another club. I think the question mark, though, is now is how well the Zerbi has done at Brighton since he's come in. So Potter got him to a level, and then he's taken him to the next level with the same group of players to some extent. So I think if his stock would have been okay at Chelsea, but now that the Zerbi's taken over, I think that's, if any people go, oh, question marks about him a little bit, about his coaching and his methods, even though before the Zerbi he was being lauded because of how good he had done with that side.
Right, I'm going to ask two of you a question. Managers are a merry-go-round. You first, Alan. Who made the biggest mistake sacking the manager?
Sacking the manager?
Yeah.
Well, you've put me on the spot there now.
I thought you knew everything.
I do, yeah, but who made the biggest mistake? Leicester sacking Brendan Rodgers.
That's
100%, because I think, again, going back to a similar point what I raised there with Potter, he had built up enough credibility to allow him the opportunity to try and get them out of that, and I think he would have got them out of it as well, and they made a massive mistake, I think.
I think they sacked him, but
he sacked himself.
He's kind of engineering himself, wasn't he, a little bit?
Yeah,
so
he wanted to go,
so I don't... I think they did sack him, but I almost felt it was by mutual consent. Both of them kind of went separate ways. But that's the only one that really jumps out, isn't it? You think, like, the only one I look at is, like, Leeds gone back to the Bielsa, but that wasn't this season.
Yeah.
That's the, you know, Jesse Marsh gone in there, they struggled last season. This year they struggled, but they sacked him after they had the window. That was crazy. They gave him a time to bring in players, and they sacked him within, what, a week or two of it? And then, you know, and then trying to bring in Sam Allardyce for four games to go. It's madness.
Is it as mad as bringing in Frank Lampard to Chelsea?
No. See, and a lot, funny enough, a lot of the ones where you're associating madness to them, it's the mismanagement upstairs of the clubs rather than actually what's going on the pitch. A lot of it is the chaos behind the scenes with the likes of that Leeds. Who's making decisions there? You know, there's no forward planning. It's almost knee-jerk stuff. And once you start getting into this knee-jerk positions and decisions, you know you're in bother.
My highlight was Evan Ferguson with Brighton, and apparently he's in Dublin tonight as well. My highlight of the season was just his breakthrough and seeing him play and watching him be able to equip himself at the level that he was, and obviously Brighton doing really well as well. Stephen, next year, will he just push on, do you reckon?
Yeah, I think he will. I think you've seen a growth in him this season, just developing wise. We've watched him, Colly and I, quite a few times for the 21s. Mm. And I think he's always been that size and stature and physical, but it's almost like he's just grown into his body. He understands it more. He's adapted to his size. Yeah, he knows how to use it. And he's playing in arguably one of the best teams to play in for a central player, because you've got Marsh, who's had his best season on the Ryan side, Matoma, who's a sensation, and McAllister and Caicedo in the middle who feed off him. But he's linked them so well. We're so lucky that we've got him, that, and he's young and he's progressive. And, you know, I've just given him Young Player of the Year and won another show because I just think he's been the standout performer, someone that's really grabbed the headlines.
He most certainly has. We wish him all the best. Lads, three teams went down. Three are coming up. Burnley, Sheffield United, Luton Town. Can they all stay up? Will any of them stay up, Alan?
I think the best position to probably stay up would be Burnley, purely because of Vincent Kompany and his experience and the job that he done as well. They all need investment, Ruby. The jump from the Championship, obviously, up to the Premier League, as we've seen over the years, is absolutely monumental. So even just finishing 17th is success for any of those three. I think Higginbottom at Sheffield United, he almost fits what the club is, isn't that they'll come up with fighting spirit and energy, and the crowd will galvanise them and all that kind of stuff. Bramall Lane, it'll be a difficult place for teams to go. Luton have obviously the toughest challenge of all, even just the stadium to host matches, never mind staying in the Premier League. But it's a brilliant story, and it's almost a throwback to years ago, and it's something lovely, because that's what turns people off football now, is the Man Cities and the Newcastle with the money regard and all those debates and discussions.
I saw Newcastle's training ground, they tweeted it out today, a video of it, like 3 minute video of their facilities. Oh wow, it's like somebody going on holidays there.
Yeah,
and
it is,
and that's the thing, like, it's like Disneyland, these places nowadays, whereas look at Luton Town and but the story is fabulous, you know.
Yeah, I think Luton as well. That's the one you think would struggle, but you never know. It's that surprise, isn't it? That shock to the system. Your first season in the Premier League, and you're an unknown entity for some teams. And to be fair, the three teams that came up this year didn't go down. So, you know, if there's something to look at and realise, then that's the way to go. Obviously, those teams invested probably a lot more heavily than what Luton are going to be able to. But the finances that's going to give that club going forward, even if they do get relegated, is astronomical for them.
Stephen, will Burnley be able to, or will Everton be able to get their act together with Sean Dyche?
Yeah, I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. And we're speaking about there, it's stuff behind the scenes that seems to happen. It's not true lack of investment. It's not true lack of you know, what they actually want to achieve, to build a new stadium. It's just more the mismanagement. The players that have come in have just fallen away. Calvert-Lewin been injured all the time, and relying on a player like that, you can't rely on him anymore. You have to kind of cut your ties out, or, you know, keep him there but get someone that's going to replace him. And when he's fit, he's fit, and then when he's not, he's not. And I think, you know, there's big changes have to happen there on the field. Deutsch is going to want to stamp his mark on it, but there's already talks of his replacement being in the pipeline, which is you know, that if those rumours are coming out, and they're coming out from the club, then is that going to make Deutsch feel comfortable in a surrounding?
One thing
as well?
With him as well, just quickly, he's a man of principle, so if there's anything going on chaotic and he doesn't feel like he's in charge, or there's a bit of madness, he'll walk.
Yeah, and he'll get a job, no bother.
And they're better served keeping him.
Yeah.
Lads, the bad news for you is we want you back next week to discuss the Cup Final and the Champions League Final. So even though the Premier League is finished, ye are not. But thanks a million for coming in this evening, Stephen Kelly and Alan Colley. We have a quick break to take.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. It's time to turn our attention to Gaelic football. I'm delighted to say that Peter Canavan joins us on the line. Peter, how are you?
Hi, Marie. How are you?
Thanks very much for joining us this evening. I want to look back on the weekend's action, but I want to just get your view on the criticism that has now been thrown at Gaelic football after the weekend. Maybe it's because it's been on at the same time as the hurling, and the hurling has been electric, but given just maybe the tempo in the Roscommon Dublin game, it wasn't the most exciting 70 minutes that people would have spent in their lives. What do you think?
Yeah, a couple of things. Marie, first of all, no, you can't compare Gaelic football to hurling, number one. But the second thing, it's not just the Dublin Roscommon game. This has been a trend in our games this past couple of years, really, whereby when teams elect to get a lot of bodies behind the ball, rather than going direct for your score, the traditional route, teams are becoming patient. They're trying to draw the opposition out. And in some cases, it used to be you held on to the ball for a minute, maybe 2 minutes, which is a lot in one game. But now we've reached a record there, I think, on Sunday. It was nearly 6 minutes. So, look, I get it that it's part and parcel of the game, and it's a tactic that managers are using. But it's terrible to watch. and it's spoiling our game as a spectacle. And I've said it before, it's bad enough when you watch, you know, senior teams, the best players in the county, in some cases the best players in the country, doing this. But when you see coaches inflicting that style of play on underage teams, then it's harder to stomach. So I've no doubt that we'll see more of it. It's inevitable that that style of game is going to continue. And in so many of the games this year already, there's been a game of chess for 50, 60 minutes, and then the last 10 minutes breaks out into a game of football. And for those that are paying a lot to see it, and for those who are watching it, it's not good enough.
Peter, I watched the Saturday game on Saturday night, and you were obviously on it, but when you showed the replays of the kickouts in the Derry Monaghan match from behind the goal, and it was like looking onto a rugby pitch. They were everyone huddled together on top of one another, but to watch it from that angle was so much more interesting, and players trying to run from space. There is so much happening off the ball. If it was televised differently, would football be a bit more entertaining?
Are you saying we're not doing our job right, Ruby?
No, I meant camera angles, not so much how you're commentating on it. If you could show way more of it. I mean, to watch those kickouts from behind the goal was fascinating.
And in our job, when we analyse games, we're always looking for something different to show the viewer that they don't get, you know, just by watching it with a normal camera angle. But do you see, when you put 15 men behind the ball, you could have 10 cameras on the game, and when the ball's been passed backwards and forwards, you know, across the side of the pitch, it doesn't make for attractive viewing. When teams go at it right, yes, there's so much, and I've said before, we don't get enough time when proper games of football are played where there's plenty of action. You don't get enough time to show everything that you want to highlight and what managers are trying to do. And you're absolutely right. The game now, and why has it descended into teams holding on to the ball for 5 or 6 minutes, is because it's become so tactical, and managers are so astute in terms of doing whatever they have to do in order to win. And I'm not blaming Roscommon 1 minute for the way in which they went out to play. If I was a Roscommon player going to Croke Park on Sunday, and my manager told me we can play a nice style of football and get beat here by 15 points, or we'll go out and try and win, there's no doubt as a player what I would want. So yeah, I fully get it. They're playing within the rules, but it's at this stage, I think for the betterment of the game, we've got to look at another approach. And I hate to say that, because there's been so many tweaks to the rules, and I know they're trying out different things now. I hate to say that, but it's inevitable that something's going to have to be done in order to make our game for a better viewing spectacle.
What would you suggest or recommend even?
I've thought about before having less players on the pitch, having 13 aside, but then what would happen? You'll the same thing's going to happen. You'll have 13 players behind it. So I think one rule that could be easily enough implemented is a team has to keep 2, maybe 3 players in the opposition's half. And if that's the case, you can't get everybody back behind the ball, and the opposition will not end up kicking the ball back and forward to their goalkeeper, because there'll be at least 3. There'll be a better chance of teams moving forward with the ball. The other option to make it the game faster would be what they've done in basketball and introduced the shot clock. But I think the referee has enough on his hands to do, and it's going to, you know, it's not that difficult in basketball. It would be extremely difficult to try and manage in Gaelic football.
A shot clock and 5 players in the opposition half. Peter Calvin is going to change the face of football.
I didn't say that, Ruby.
We're only slagging.
Peter, thank you so much. We didn't even get a chance to get into the games because we ended up talking about the game itself.
Something way more interesting.
Yeah, that was really interesting. Thanks as always, Peter, and we will chat to you next week. It is all we have time for here, I'm afraid. I'll be back tomorrow anyway.